K-Mud Podcast presents.
Good morning and welcome to Heart of the Earth. This is a program about Native Americans and other indigenous cultures. My name is Agnes, and I opened with Blackstone, It's a Good Day to Dance, the title cut from their CD, and that's one way of keeping your body warm on these cold days, just to dance around. And today I'm going to begin by reading about Jesse Jackson. This is Black History Month, but it's also Jesse Jackson, who passed away on Monday morning. He was an ally to Native people. And so this one, first one is from Native News Online, Levi Rickard, who says, the Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr., a cornerstone of the American Civil Rights Movement and a two-time presidential candidate, died February 17th of 2026 at his home in Chicago. He was 84. Jackson, a Baptist minister, died surrounded by his family following years of health challenges, including Parkinson's disease. Born in Greenville, South Carolina, in 1941, Jackson rose from the segregated South to national prominence as a protege of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. He marched alongside King during pivotal battles for voting rights and civil liberties in the 1960s, founding his activism on direct confrontation with Jim Crow laws and economic oppression. Jackson is most frequently recognized for his leadership in Black civil rights and his historic bids for the Democratic presidential nomination in 1984 and 1988. However, his Rainbow Coalition philosophy championed solidarity among all marginalized groups, including Native Americans, Latinos, and the poor. Though not a central figure in Native American-led movements, Jackson frequently used his platform to support indigenous causes. In 1997, he supported the Colorado River Native Nations Alliance in its efforts to protect a sacred site from nuclear waste dumping. In 2000, he advocated for the release of activist Leonard Peltier during the final months of the Clinton administration. And in 2016, Jackson traveled to the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation during the #NoDAPL protest, stating the tribe's cause was precious to him. And in March of 2020, while campaigning for Senator Bernie Sanders, Jackson spoke at Calder Plaza in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And during his speech, he highlighted the shared struggles of marginalized communities. Quote, "With the exception of Native Americans, African Americans are the people who are most behind socially and economically in the United States, and our needs are not moderate," Jackson said. On Tuesday, Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hotskin Jr. said Reverend Jackson was a fierce warrior for racial, social, and economic justice and a friend to the Cherokee people. Quote, "During his career, he spoke out on many of the causes and concerns of Indian country, often equating the treatment of Native Americans and the enslavement of Black people as two of America's original sins to which we should all commit ourselves to reconcile and from which we must all heal," Hopkins said in a statement. And from Mark Thant, I believe is how he pronounced his name. He's just really well known in the Native journalism world. He's a distinguished Shoshone Bannock journalist and author of over 50 years of experience chronicling indigenous news and public policy. He was one of the, I think, one of the original editors of Indian Country Today. I have his books. I've just read so many of his articles. And I interviewed him way back when, But this is what he says. "I first met Jesse Jackson in 1978. He was speaking at a youth conference in Washington with Billy Mills. It was electric. He had youth from across Indian country standing up and shouting, 'I am somebody.' Young, urban, reservation, poor, none of that mattered. Everyone has dignity and can contribute. A few years later, he was the first presidential candidate to specifically campaign in Indian country. I was editor of the Navajo Times, and in 1984, Jackson spoke before the Navajo Tribal Council in Window Rock, Arizona, and then again at an event in Shiprock, New Mexico. I was not present, stuck in the newsroom, but the reporters and photographers talked about how powerful those moments were. He had the council responding exactly as he did with teenagers a few years earlier, standing up shouting, 'I am somebody.' Jackson's presidential run, the Rainbow Coalition, showed that there was an alternative to the smoke-filled rooms and the donor-driven presidential campaigns. People power had potential. I don't think I have heard any candidate, including Barack Obama, at least at the beginning, as informed as Jackson on federal Indian policy. He knew his stuff from treaties and the Supremacy Clause to the importance of economic development. The Washington Post, quote, he amassed more than 3 million votes during the primaries, and he took 384 delegates with him to the Democratic National Convention in San Francisco. From an initial field of 8 candidates, he finished third in the primary campaign behind former Vice President Walter Mondale, the eventual nominee, and Senator Gary Hart of Colorado. Quote, when they write the history of the primary campaign, the longest chapter will be on Jackson, Mario Cuomo, the New York governor, said to the Post at the time. Quote, the man didn't have 2 cents. He didn't have one television or radio ad. And look what he did. 4 years later, Jackson ran again and more than doubled the number of votes he earned. The last time I visited with Jesse Jackson was in 2004. I had just asked President George Bush about sovereignty. The event was over and I was still on stage and I could see Jackson standing. He motioned to me, come here, and I went over. He looked very serious and scolded me. Quote, you didn't understand the president, he said. Then he launched into a riff about sovereignty and you've been sovereignized. Then he threw his head back and laughed. The same night, he was on Democracy Now! And repeated his take on Bush's sovereignty moment. Jackson's legacy is extraordinary. He changed the nature of political campaigns. He inspired countless young people to run for office, all sorts of offices, and he reminded us about our own inherent dignity and personal power. And thank you, Mark. And this is from Julia Francella. And yes, it's entitled Servant Leaders in honor of Reverend Jesse Jackson and Black History Month. And she says, some deaths feel personal even when you didn't know the person. Reverend Jesse Jackson is one of those. Today, like the rest of the world, I'm grieving the loss of Reverend Jesse Jackson, a civil rights leader, minister, and political force who carried the movement forward for decades after Dr. King. His family said, quote, our father was a servant leader, not only to our family, but to the oppressed, the voiceless, and the overlooked around the world. That's the legacy, servant leader, a life built around lifting people who were treated as disposable. And because I'm Indigenous, this is how my mind moves when someone like that passes. I think about relationships, not only between people, but between people and the living world. How do we honor such incredible servant leaders? When someone like that dies, I always feel this urge to make something that's a quiet offering, and a way to honor them. I seem to process grief through painting, and that's where the leaves come in. I was raised with teachings that everything is alive. Trees can carry, leaves hold memory. Even after a leaf has fallen, it still holds the energy of where it's been. Sun, rain, wind, season, time. Painting on them is my way of staying in relationship while I honor people who spend their lives staying in relationship with us. That's why I often paint portraits on fallen leaves. To me, it feels like a respectful collaboration with something that already has a story, something that holds our collective memory. And I just want to interject here. The photos of the two paintings she did on leaves just blew me out of the water. It was just so incredible to see. But to continue, in honor of Black History Month, I wanted to hold up the tradition Reverend Jackson stood in the lineage of servant leaders. So I'm sharing the paintings of two of them on fallen leaves, Audre Lorde and Harriet Tubman. Audre Lorde was many things at once, a poet, an essayist, a teacher, a Black lesbian feminist, and a mother who refused to make her life smaller to be more, quote, acceptable. She wrote with the kind of clarity that tells the truth, and then it asks you what you're going to do with it. What I love about Lorde is that she never treated language as decoration. For her, words were survival. She wrote about racism, sexism, homophobia, cancer, and the everyday violence of being asked to disappear. And she did it without losing her tenderness or her fire. Lord, believe that naming what hurts is part of the work of changing it, and that silence isn't neutral. It has consequences. One line of hers comes back again and again because it still feels like a hand on the shoulder. Quote, "My silences had not protected me. Your silence will not protect you." That line is a match stuck in the dark. It asks for courage. It asks for truth. It asks us to stop waiting for a safer time. When I paint her on a leaf, I'm thinking about that kind of bravery, that kind of simplicity, that kind that simply insists, "I am here. I am speaking. I will not shrink." I painted Harriet Tubman on a leaf I found near her memorial in Harlem. It was already off the branch, already on its way back to the earth, and still it felt like it carried a pulse. Veins like tiny roads, a small, ordinary thing that has already done its season of work and still had more to give. That's what I keep coming back to with Tubman. She didn't just reach freedom and stop. She went back. Again and again, she returned to danger with a kind of steady purpose to free other people. Her words land that same calm resolve. Quote, "I had reasoned this out in my mind. There was one of two things I had the right to, liberty or death. If I could not have one, I would have the other." I read that and know it's the voice of someone who understood what she owed to herself and what she was willing to carry for others, that servant leadership in its purest form. Reverend Jesse Jackson spent a lifetime insisting that dignity belongs to the poor, the pushed aside, the overlooked, to all of us. He showed what it looks like when leadership is rooted in moral obligation, not ego. I keep thinking about how a leaf falls without losing its purpose. It returns to the earth, it feeds the soil around it, and it becomes part of what comes next. That's what real leadership does too. Reverend Jesse Jackson served with a steadiness that outlived the moment, and this month, let us try to honor that kind of life. If this post resonates, share it and then do one tangible thing in the direction of justice this week. Check on someone who is struggling. Support a Black-led organization. Teach a young person a piece of history they weren't given. That's how we honor servant leaders. May we carry their names gently and keep doing the work. Happy Black History Month. And I honor the people that saved all the history of slavery that was in a national monument in Pennsylvania and put it all back.
This is our history. This is the way it was. This is History 101. A great civilization existed in this land we call America, long before the people who came to colonize even knew that the world was round. Pima, Diné, Mohawk, Ojibwe, Lakota, Creek, Seminole, Cree, Miskasuki, Homas, Choctaw, Nisqually, Suquamish, Duwamish, Pawnee, Cheyenne, Apache, Arapaho, Navajo, Mohican, Seneca, Tunica, Shoshone, the people now called Indian. There were varied cultures, all with traditions that involved guarding and nurturing and keeping the earth, our mother, honoring all other living creatures. But colonists from a far land beyond the ocean arrived here, seeking to own, to conquer and subdue the wilderness and its inhabitants, to subdue the earth, to conquer nature. This would require a lot of work. More work than the colonists could do themselves. More work than the colonists were willing to do themselves. More work than the colonists were capable of doing themselves. They needed laborers. They needed someone to do this dirty work for them. And so another ancient civilization was called upon to supply the labor. Yoruba, Mandinka, Zulu, Igbo, princes from Dahomey, princess from the Congo, king from Kikuyu, Maasai, Africans. These people were brought in chains, under duress, forced to work under pain of death. This is our history. This is the way it was. This is history 101. There were cultural similarities and similarities in the attitudes of the colonists toward both of these groups of people, and this gave these two groups common cause. Together, maybe they could successfully resist. But the colonial officials saw this danger and they took the step to prevent an alliance. Hire Indians as slave hunters. Force the slaves to fight the Indians. Create fear, hatred, distrust. Subjugate both peoples. Divide and conquer. Now, this strategy worked to a certain extent, but in some areas, Seminoles and Africans joined forces and fought to the bitter end. Homers and Choctaws and Africans joined each other in the southern swamps and fought. And in New Orleans and Congo Square, Choctaws, Homers, Africans got together to express the similarities in their culture in music and dance. And to this day in New Orleans, there are people who are known as Mardi Gras Indians who honor and commemorate the cooperation, respect, and alliance of the African and the Indian and African, African and Indian, Indian and African. This is our history. This is the way it was. This is history 101. African Americans and Native Americans. Native Americans and African Americans are strangers to each other today. We are brothers and sisters of the same blood, brothers and sisters of the same spirit, brothers and sisters from the same mud, our mother, the earth. We must know each other. We must learn. The thing that separates us today is lack of knowledge and understanding. This is our history. This is the way it is. This is history 101.
And that was the song Catcher's History 101. And it came from their great CD, Dreaming in Color. And they had, and the late Charles Neville was helping them on that song. Well, this is originally appeared in the Grist and then in Indian Country Today. And yeah, it's all about Billy English, stolen land, and the climate cost of America's dispossession. When Billie Eilish told Grammy audiences that, quote, no one is illegal on stolen land, she ignited a small firestorm that went beyond celebrity discourse, revealing deep fault lines in how America confronts its own history. Critics accused her of hypocrisy, pointing out that her multi-million-dollar Los Angeles home sits on Tongva land. Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas invoked her line in a Senate hearing, calling the entertainment world, quote, deeply corrupt. Meanwhile, pundits and commentators spawned online backlash and memes, and the Washington Post published an op-ed defending property law and dismissing land restitution. Quote, no, Billie Eilish, Americans are not thieves on stolen land, op-ed authors Richard Epstein and Max Raskin wrote on Thursday. Only days before, Eilish responded to ongoing immigration and custom enforcement raids and killings by pointing to Americans' history of violent colonization and genocide directed at indigenous peoples. The Washington Post authors argue, quote, it's time to put Eilish's theory of property out to pasture, arguing, quote, it is easy to call land stolen, but what about the innocent purchasers who acquired in good faith in the interim? Are they thieves? The language, these arguments are reasonably predictable. They appear when indigenous dispossession is pushed into the public eye. But there are countless examples throughout history of indigenous peoples being forced to cede land under threat of violence. Take, for example, what is currently Washington State. Between 1854 and 1855, territorial governor Isaac Stevens pressured tribes in the region into ceding much of the West Coast to the United States. His warning to Yakima chief Kamiakin was explicit, quote, if you do not accept the offer, you will walk in blood knee deep. The threat was not rhetorical. Less than a decade earlier, the California Gold Rush brought settlers west and culminated in what California Governor Gavin Newsom would later call genocide. Quote, no other way to describe it, Newsom said in 2019. That's the way it needs to be described in the history books. The U.S. frequently combined economic pressure, unequal bargaining power, and the threat of military force in treaty negotiations. And I just have to interject here, because when I read, you know, about what Governor Newsom said, he had made sure that the real history of California is taught to children. And I remember, you know, when I was in elementary school in the 50s, and we'd have to watch these little black and white stories about, you know, the Indians and how they were, but it was just, you know, slave-like, and how they built the missions, and, you know, it was just really disgusting, and, you know, all you learned about was the missions, not, you know, so much about the native people that were forced to build them. But to continue, the U.S. frequently combined economic pressure, unequal bargaining power, and the threat of military force in treaty negotiations and establishing Minnesota was no different. The federal government withheld rations promised to tribes after previous land cessions and allowed settlers to violate previous treaties, which are federal law, in order to hunt and claim land in agreed-upon Indian territory. With the treaties of 1851 signed at Mendota and Traverse des Sioux, the Dakota Nation was forced to cede 35 million acres, nearly the entire bottom half of what later became Minnesota. Tensions eventually led to the Dakota War, a 5-week conflict that forced the removal of nearly all indigenous peoples from the state. Those actions, that war, have also been called genocide by Holocaust and genocide scholars, as well as the act's direct beneficiaries, the Minneapolis and St. Paul City Councils. In the Washington Post, Epstein and Raskin refer to the land acknowledgments that spring from these histories as, quote, accepting generational guilt, adding that statements of apology, like those by the state of California, quote, thankfully, don't transfer title backward to the original owners, for if they did, civilization would collapse. Hey, my next story is about all this land that the Washoe, it's like 10,000 acres that was returned to them. So you're quite mistaken, Mr. Epstein and Raskins. Okay, and civilization is not collapsing because they just got that land back. All right. Scholars of settler colonialism have long documented how the U.S. has framed whiteness as synonymous with civilization while casting indigenous people as obstacles to progress, a racist framework where owning property becomes the key market to civilization. Epstein and Raskin's argument operates squarely within this tradition. By treating property rights as the foundation of civilization, it obscures the history that made them possible: war, forced removal, forced assimilation of children, and policies that historians and government officials have described as genocide. Take, for instance, the Morrell Act of 1862, which used land taken from tribal nations to fund the land-grant university system. Nearly 11 million acres taken from more than 250 tribes to establish 52 universities. Then there are state enabling acts, laws passed by Congress that authorized the formation of a state government and allowed for admission to the Union. As indigenous homelands became territories and territories became states, nearly formed state governments carved out land out of their newly acquired, quote, public domain. They're enabling acts to fund state institutions, services, and public works, and those lands are now known as state trust lands. The primary purpose of state trust lands was education, and has remained so to this day. Land-grant colleges, for instance, opened their doors with the help of the Morrell Act, and then states stepped in with more income from the state trust lands. Grist investigations have since identified 14 land-grant universities still benefiting from more than 8 million acres of land taken from 123 indigenous nations through 150 indigenous land cessions. This land generated approximately $6.6 billion in profit between 2018 and 2022. And nearly 25% of the state trust lands that benefit land universities are designated for mining or fossil fuel production. In Montana, oil and gas extraction, timber, grazing, and other activities on state trust lands generated $62 million for public institutions, with the majority of the cash going to K-12 schools. 10 states use nearly 2 million acres of state trust lands to fund state prison systems. In 2024, those lands dispersed an estimated $33 million in funding to those facilities, and at least 79 reservations in 15 states have state trust lands within their boundaries, an estimated 2 million acres, that provide revenue to support public institutions and reduce the financial burden on taxpayers. Quote, every dollar earned by the land office, said New Mexico Commissioner of Public Lands Stephanie Garcia Richard said in 2019, quote, is a dollar taxpayers do not have to pay to support public institutions. In at least four states, tribal nations pay states for access to those lands despite being within their own territorial boundaries. An estimated 11,000 acres, the Ute tribe paid the state of Utah more than $25,000 to graze on those trust lands in 2023 alone. And while critics have quick to point out that institutions like K-12 schools benefit everyone, it's important to remember that many tribal members don't attend state-run schools at all. They enroll in Bureau of Indian Educational Schools that receive funding from the federal government. At least they did. But return of those lands remain mired in bureaucracy. In 2024, Grist reported that more than 90,000 state trust lands inside the Yakima Reservation, the reservation created under threat of walking knee-deep in blood, were mistakenly carved from the Yakima Nation due to a federal filing error. The tribe has sought for its land to be returned for nearly 7 decades, but Washington has refused to let them go. American property laws say the state's ownership over those lands is legal because the state holds the deed. But Washington acknowledges that this is an injustice and that land should be returned to the tribe. However, then Commissioner of Public Lands Hillary Franz argued that righting the wrong would take revenue away from beneficiaries like K-12 schools. The state, therefore, would need to be compensated for their loss of revenue, even though those lands were wrongfully taken in the first place. And between 2021 and 2023, those state trust lands generated about $573,000 for state beneficiaries, less than 1% of all revenue from all trust lands across Washington state. In the Washington Post op-ed, the writers say that, quote, the effort to undo the past would involve trillions of dollars in transfer payments and coerce title shifts that would unsettle every home mortgage, every mining and oil lease. They are correct. To return land to tribal nations would be to unsettle, pun intended, the very foundations that drive climate change and threaten life on the planet, a fact echoed by more than 600 scientists and conservation studies over the past 20 years that say indigenous land return offers significant environmental returns with serious implications for tackling climate change. Ultimately, the controversy surrounding Eilish's remark reveals less about celebrity or even property than the limits of America's moral imagination, including at influential media outlets. Democracy may die in darkness, but America was built in daylight. And in America, oppression and injustice don't need shadows to thrive. They need champions.
Lumbuck, the colonize the earth where you mind that. Indigenous soul, pray we find that. All I want a world in alignment. Lumbuck, Lumbuck. The colonize the earth where your mind at. All around the world in alignment. See the new dawn on the horizon. Not for sale, cause creation free. Water, air and land are commodity. What the farmer seed, that's the pharmacy. Solidarity, the people's sovereignty. Remember that food that we used to grow in names and a language that we used to know. Indigenous stewards of the natural. Restore the sacred hoop for survival. Being a billionaire is not brilliant. Money print every day, more presidents. There's still reservations on the continent. We relatives, they still call us savages. Community, that remedy. Their medicine, please, your humility. Land trust, show me tax or security. Sacred sites, all nations coordinate. Lumbuck, Lumbuck. The colonize the earth for your mind that. All around the world in alignment. See the new dawn on the horizon.
I'm water.
We're dependent on our mother, we are not the owners. And for us to coexist, we got to get to know her. Language and the land shape each other over time. Native tongues wake up medicine deep inside. We were stolen from her lands, now she wants us back. Native ceremonies help get us back on track. There is nothing that could keep us from our sacred places. Ancestors calling us, they recognize our faces. Real question is, do we recognize ourselves? Or do we fight over who suffered more from what was dealt? The solution is more than acquired wealth. What we need is a higher quality of health. Everybody benefits from growing native seeds. Every ecosystem thrives in diversity. Native voices rise up for the comeback. Give us back to the land, do we heal that?
Repatriation, repatriation, reparation, regeneration. Worldwide liberation.
worldwide illumination, rematriation, repatriation, reparation, regeneration, worldwide liberation, worldwide illumination. Lombok, Lombok, colonize the earth where your mind at. Indigenous soul, pray we find that. All I want a world in alignment. Lombok, Lombok, colonize the earth where your mind at. All I want a world in alignment. See the new dawn on the horizon.
Remember those seeds that we used to sow. Pass through the dreams that we used to know. Remember those ways of the natural. Giving our praise to the material lineage, it can never be material. Object, no profit, no cereal. Codes can be placed on the elements. We show nothing but respect to our relatives to maintain life that's so relevant. No corporation should be selling it with the hands in the pockets of the lobbyists. We stand with the people, no politics. Restoration, the new prerogative. Only take what we need and leave offerings. All the nations play a part in this. Set of ancient trade routes across continents.
Nanmak is when people get smart. When they get smart, they humble themselves and they realize the destruction that they've caused, maybe unintentionally. The mining, the dams, the pipelines, has a cumulative effect, and that effect is devastating. And by returning the land to the people who were chosen by Creator to steward those lands in our own way, we can reestablish the guidelines so we can reincorporate safety measures, so we can develop codes to protect these waters. It's not just about returning the land, it's much more than that. And then our future will be secured.
And that was Rebel Wise, Land Back. And he had some help from Desiree Harp, Ashell, and C-Sun Z. Yeah, thank you, Rebel Wise. Yes, the Washoe Tribe of Nevada and California announced last Wednesday that it has completed the purchase of more than 10,000 acres of ancestral land in the Sierra Nevada, marking the largest tribal land return ever completed in the mountain range and the third largest in California. And civilization didn't collapse, you guys, from Washington Post. Nope. All right. The tribe acquired 10,274 acres northeast of Lake Tahoe and about 20 miles north of Reno. Land formerly known as Loyalton Ranch, the property will now be known as the Wealmetelti, I believe is how it's pronounced, Preserve, and will be held by the tribe's land trust. Tribal leaders and conservation partners said the acquisition restores ecologically significant Washoe homelands to tribal ownership and represents a major step toward addressing generations of displacement. The return of this land is deeply meaningful for our people, said Chairman Sorrell Smokey of the Washoe Tribe of Nevada and California. Quote, these lands are part of who we are and have been stewarded by the Washoe people since time immemorial. The land trust was established by the Washoe Tribal Council in 2025 to accelerate the repatriation of ancestral lands across the tribe's traditional Sierra Nevada territory. Tribal leaders said the purchase is intended to support long-term cultural preservation, ecological stewardship, and healing from historical trauma. The acquisition was supported by a coalition of conservation organizations and public partners, including the Northern Sierra Partnership, the Feather River Land Trust, and the California Wildlife Conservation Board. quote, "This project demonstrates what is possible when conservation and tribal leadership move forward together," said Lucy Blake, president of the Northern Sierra Partnership. The land encompasses forests, meadows, and wildlife habitat considered critical to regional ecological health. Partners said tribal ownership will ensure the area is managed using traditional knowledge alongside modern and conservation practices. "This return is about more than acreage," said Corey Pargee, executive director of the Feather River Land Trust. Quote, "It's about restoring stewardship to the people who have cared for this landscape for thousands of years." Jennifer Norris, executive director of the Wildlife Conservation Board, said the project reflects growing recognition of tribes as essential leaders in conservation. Tribal officials said additional details about the acquisition and future plans for the preserve will be released following an official announcement. So, yes, land back, and it's all about the future generations.
The seventh generation is about vision. It's about leadership looking ahead. It's about responsibility. Seventh generation reminds you that you have responsibility to generations that are coming, and that you indeed are in charge of life as it is at the moment. Every generation has its time, and every generation has its leaders, and every generation has its heroes. Every generation has all of that. And when that generation passes, the next generation will have the same.
The plethora rounds aimed at people. There are big OC canisters as well.
They will also have their leaders. They will also have their heroes. They will also have their problems. And they will also have the continuing responsibility to look out for the next seven generations.
We need you to back away from here. We need you to stop.
Because people talk about their rights, but they never talk about their responsibility. And leadership has got to have that above all. They've got to have vision. They've got to have compassion for the future. They've got to make that decision for the seventh generation. That's not just a casual term. That's a real instruction for survival.
Rest here. We've got militia. This is militia that's going on right now. They've attacked. As you see, they have drawn. The weapons are drawn.
And of the 100 dominant economic units in the world today, 49 are countries and 51 are corporations. You digest that for a second. What does that mean? It means that corporations are the driving force of decision-making today. And corporations are not concerned with human rights. They're not concerned with human life. They're not even concerned with a proper wage for the people that are working for them. So what kind of decisions are going to be made on our behalf? Oh, there's going to be hell to pay, as they say. That people have to become aware and become awake, and power is always in the people's hands, authority. They need to come of one mind, and they need to challenge the values that are being shoved at them today, because this has become a consumer society. It's driven by economics. It's not driven by common sense.
In the United States of America.
And that was Sten Jody giving us seventh generation. Before I get into my next story, I just want to make mention that I have a photo exhibit that is at the Garberville Library. It's mainly black and whites. There's a lot of community members in them. So if you're stuck in town and you need something to do in the afternoon, go to the library, just not to see my photos that are on display, but also to check out the library, because it's just a vital part of our community now. So many good things happen on Saturday, the 28th, which is about 10 days away. There's going to be a jigsaw puzzle exchange. So if you're into jigsaw puzzles and you have some, and you can just bring them in between, I think it's 2 and 6 o'clock. You bring them in and just put them on the table, and then you can take whatever you want. It's just a free trade, and it's just a lot of fun. And in these cold winter days, doing jigsaw puzzles are a lot of fun. I'm going to share this story with you because we've been listening to so much about hearing so much about the Epstein files. We haven't heard enough. We haven't heard the truth, everything that's been redacted. But, you know, it's horrible the way these young girls were groomed. I mean, that's why I had such a hard time with Michael Franti. You know, if he wanted to have affairs with somebody against his wife, that's his business. But when you find someone, you know, on Instagram and on the internet, and you invite them to come on your tour, and then you spend months grooming them, I mean, that's, no, you know, that's something entirely different. So I thought I'd share this with you because you know, it's just, it happens in Indian country. And yeah, Nevada jury convicts Nathan Chasing Horse on 13 counts in high profile abuse case. A Nevada jury has convicted former Dances with Wolves actor and self-proclaimed Lakota spiritual leader Nathan Chasing Horse on 13 felony counts, concluding a years-long case that prosecutors say exposed a pattern of sexual abuse carried out under the guise of indigenous healing practices. The verdict delivered Friday in Clark County District following 2 days of deliberations. Chasing Horse, 49, was found guilty of multiple counts of sexually assaulting a minor, including a girl he began abusing at age 14, according to prosecutors. He was acquitted on several other charges, including kidnapping and child pornography-related counts. And during the trial, prosecutors argued that Chasing Horse used his reputation as a medicine man to gain access to vulnerable indigenous women and girls. They said he cultivated a following known as the Circle, whose members believed he possessed spiritual powers and healing abilities. This influence, according to testimony presented in court, allowed him to isolate victims, normalize sexual abuse, and silence those who tried to speak out. The investigation began in 2023 after Las Vegas police received multiple reports from women who said Chasing Horse had abused them for years. A SWAT raid on his home uncovered evidence that supported the allegations, police said in affidavits filed at the time. The prosecution faced setbacks early on in 2024. The Nevada Supreme Court dismissed the original indictment, forcing the state to reassemble its case. The new charges were filed later that year, and the trial began in January of 2026. Chasing Horse showed little emotion as the verdict was read, according to reporters inside the courtroom. His attorney called the outcome disappointing and said the defense plans to file motions for a new trial. The case has drawn widespread attention across Indian country, where Chasing Horse has traveled for decades as a spiritual figure. Many tribal advocates said the verdict represents long overdue accountability for abuses that often go unreported or unprosecuted. Quote, "This is a moment survivors have waited for," one advocate said outside the courthouse, according to local media coverage. And Chasing Horse faces a minimum of 25 years in prison, with sentencing scheduled for March 11th of 2026, according to the court records. All right, I am. I'm going to close with something from Earl Bullhead, and I really appreciate his, and this is positive thinking, and I think, you know, the way everything is going on right now, we just have to keep positive thinking. A lot of times there's so much negativity going on, but there's balance, you know, there's balance in the positivity. Sometimes we just don't see it. So, yeah, be positive, stay positive, and I'll be back next week. Keep your ears tuned to the mud because Women on Wednesday coming right up with BR. Hey.
This has been a KMUD podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast and also on our website, kmud.org.